Rough Trade is giving away a third of the first 3 months of the Rough Trade Club plus new music membership exclusively to 101 Part-Time Jobs listeners. Become a member of Rough Trade Club New Music and you'll receive the Rough Trade Album of the Month straight to your door every month on an exclusive vinyl pressing with bonus material. Club members have received exclusive pressings of albums from Sufjan Stevens, Sprints, The Last Dinner Party, English Teacher, and Over Mono, just to name a few, this past year alone. Sign up using the promo code CLUB101POD and you'll get Rough Trade's Album of the Month, Camera Obscura's Look to the East, Look to the West, for a third of the usual price. By signing up, you'll be getting Rough Trade's exclusive issue of the album on opaque purple in a gatefold sleeve, plus a bonus CD containing 5 demos. Don't want the album of the month but still want all the benefits? Sign up to the standard tier using CLUB101POD and you'll still get the first month free. You'll also get free shipping on all orders, 10% off at the bar and on secondhand vinyl in store, and exclusive access to sold out Rough Trade events. So don't hang around. Head to roughtrade.com/club and sign up with the code CLUB101POD. That's CLUB101POD and claim money off Rough Trade's Album of the Month today. This offer is for UK residents only. Do you play in bands? I did for the longest time, and I wish that I knew that DistroKid was a thing. I don't even think it existed back then. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and artists keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. 1 million+ artists rely on DistroKid to get their music on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all the major streaming services. When you get DistroKid, you can see a DistroKid bank and withdraw your earnings. You get notified when you've earned royalties and you can withdraw via the app. And you can even check your streaming stats on Spotify and Apple. Get 30% off your first year on DistroKid by going to distrokid.com/VIP/101pod. 30% off for your first year. That's not bad. We know it's a tough world out there. Why don't you make it easier for yourself? And to get 30% off that free year as an artist, where you get 100% of your royalties and earnings, go to distrokid.com/VIP/101pod. All right, stay with me. I'll be right back after this.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to 101 Part-Time Jobs podcast with me, Giles Bidder, where I speak to bands and artists about the other jobs they've had. And this week I speak to Brian Devendorf, drummer of The National, and he's just released a record under the name Royal Green, along with Nate Martinez, and also featuring Josh Kaufman from Bonnie Light Horseman and fellow National member Aaron Dessner. Brian tells me about working for a small book publisher in his 20s in New York, around the time that The National felt like a bit of a pipe dream to him and they were rehearsing in apartments, before touring really took over when Alligator was released in 2005, and how that was such a turning point in his life. I'm sure I'm not alone in thinking it's fucking awesome hearing about the kind of reality that they were going through around that time. So thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please make sure you subscribe and maybe leave behind some kind of compassionate, warming review. East London Signature Brew have been brewing music-inspired beers since 2011 and have released beers with Mastodon, with Idols, with Slaves, with a bunch of other awesome bands. And if you go onto their website, well, if you live in the UK, signaturebrew.co.uk, you can order beers and get 10% off everything with the voucher code 101podcast. That's all capital letters. You're listening to 101 Part-Time Jobs, and here's Brian Devendorf from Royal Green and The National. I've been really enjoying the Royal Green record, Brian, and it makes me think, you know, looking at your discogs, looking at how prolific you've been as a songwriter and a collaborator, how has that changed over the last decade plus?
Oh, well, Where to begin?
Right.
First of all, thanks for the kind words. First of all, I should qualify this. I didn't really write. I wrote one of the lyric sets on the Royal Green recording. It's all covers of, you know, established classic rock songs and also lyric sets by Matt Berninger.
Wow. I knew the lyrics were written by someone else, but not Matt.
Yeah, they were actually kind of like the early batch of national material that did not make the first record was just kind of lying fallow. So I just kind of used it in this little this bedroom recording. I mean, the recording of Royal Green, it was my vocals were recorded 20 years ago.
The vocals that we're here on the, that we hear on the record.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like a time capsule from the early days of the band of the National, you know.
Wow, that's insane.
Yeah, it was just a project just based on just learning how to use Pro Tools, you know.
Right. And did you feel much?
And then I dug it up. Sorry, go ahead.
Did you feel much pressure? Was there any kind of anything like that around making this, putting it together, learning Pro Tools?
That's the thing. There was no pressure other than that I put on myself. You know, just I was, you know, 25 years old, kind of living hand to mouth, and just trying to figure out technology and drum machines. And there were these synths. Like I'm not a trained musician. I dabbled in violin for about 10 years as a child, and then, you know, studied drums like kind of with teachers and stuff. But I don't have any grasp of musical theory other than the most basic understanding, you know.
So has been arranging this, did that sort of give you put a lot of memories in your head from that time?
Oh, certainly, yeah, because something about that era when, you know, the National was just a pipe dream, and, you know, New York is such a daunting, difficult place to, you know, break into whatever, you know, field you want to get into. At the time, I was actually working in book publishing on a career path, trying to become a full editor.
Wow.
So music was just kind of like, you know, fun. Something fun to do at night.
And working in publishing, that's quite an intense career, isn't it?
It can be. Luckily, I was at a very small press that had 4 people, including myself. So it was just very quiet. It was like old school, just reading manuscripts. We were one of the few presses that actually considered the slush pile, you know, the unsolicited manuscripts that come in.
Yeah.
So that was my job, just reading all the slush, you know.
And you're practicing weekend nights or weekday nights and playing weekend nights?
Yeah, basically. Matt had a large apartment that doubled as the band's rehearsal space.
Great.
In the beginning, eventually we started renting spaces and various warehouses, but yeah, I was just kind of juggling both, you know, the literary career and the musical career and just trying to make ends meet to, you know, pay the rent.
Of course, you know, every person has this kind of, maybe, you know, they look back on their life and think, wow, how, you know, from there to there to there, you know, from points A to F or whatever, you know, the current day.
Oh, yeah.
What kind of stories have kind of been re-emulated now from that time?
Well, strangely, my life is full of coincidences, like everyone's, I guess. Like, I got the job at the publishing company through Aaron's college roommate, who now lives in Cincinnati, 2 blocks from me.
Wow.
Working as a professor of philosophy at the local university. I guess, where am I going with this? It's just the random nature of all these incidents that have led up to like the fabric of my life. You know, the twins I met, my mom decided me to send me to, like, you know, private school in the late 80s. And had she not done that, there would be no National, you know?
Right.
Because that's where I met the twins and eventually formed a band, you know, probably around 1990 with them. It's just, I think coming from Ohio as well, there's like a certain glue where you're like, you're stuck with your family and, you know, your whole life.
And then moving to New York, did you all move to New York around the same time?
Essentially, yeah. I think Scott and Matt went there first. I lived with Scott and his future spouse when I first got there. And then Aaron was attending school there. This is all about, you know, 95, 96, 97, you know.
And you talk about sort of living hand to mouth. In that period of time, were you kind of expected, was there this expectation at, you know, the ripe age of 25, unlike now perhaps, to have a full-time gig, to be looking to buying a place?
Oh, no, there was no expectation. You know, it was just... I don't even know what the there were no long-term plans other than like paying the rent and hopefully getting like maybe landing a higher paying job in publishing one day. And then, you know, there were always hopes surrounding the band, but it seemed impossible at the time, you know.
Some of the lyrics that are on the Royal Green record, are there any particular ones that stand out that Matt's written or that Matt wrote back then? And you...
Wow, I mean, they all really feel strong to me, but I would say, I don't know that this really pertains to, you know, becoming an adult or anything, but there's a song called Breaking the River, and great basically song. All of it I like, you know, I want to be wanted, I want to be blamed, blah, 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 but the one I like the most is the... I want to fish where you go swimming, you know?
Yeah.
It just kind of like brings up, it evokes, you know, all the sort of childhood memories and kind of encapsulates the entirety of like human lust and wanting things into like a sentence, you know?
Totally. And I'm glad you brought up Breaking the River, because I wanted to ask where that, I've been racking my brains and trying to Google the lines about, the quote that you've got. It sounds like it's from a movie. What's that from, about being in Europe and then it wouldn't be like this in America, kind of,
right? Oh, you would never do this sort of thing in America. Yeah, the speaker, he's talking about going on a train, and it's a very posh gentleman, you know, who has a taxi man who takes him to the station and all that.
Yeah,
and all that.
Hugh Grant.
It was just a piece of found audio I found. I was archiving audio for a project. I just kind of recycled it.
It just sounded so cool. Well.
Yeah, it just sounded cool. It like kind of fit, you know, chronological, or it fit, the timestamp was just right, you know, or the duration, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And when did you start making this record?
Probably the summer of 2000.
Wow.
And then I kind of when Bryce wasn't around, I went to his apartment. He had roommates. I think it was like a three-bedroom apartment, and his bedroom was also a studio. So I just kind of, it was before phones. I don't know how we arranged anything, but somehow I knew when he wouldn't be there, and he allowed me, just let me in, and, you know, I just worked there on random days.
What a funny concept in itself, you know, not having a WhatsApp group.
Right.
Were there any kind of mistimed judgments, like missed gigs, missed rehearsals?
I'm sure there were. Well, as far as gigs go, I don't think we ever missed a gig. We were very punctual and eager and all that. You know, we weren't that cool.
And did you come to England quite early on in your career then to tour?
France was our first overseas sort of small success. And then I think shortly thereafter, it would have been London. We were, I believe, yeah, that was it. That was the year, yeah, we rented like a British vehicle, you know, with the steering wheel on the right side, because the tour started in England. They had to drive all over Europe in this British car.
Yeah. So yeah.
It was bonkers. But yeah, I think England was early on, you know, must have been 03 or 04, probably.
So at that point, you'd be in a band a few years, enough to sort of have, a pretty good organizational quality of the band?
We had no concept of, you know, tour managers and anything. We just kind of brought our whatever professional expertise we had, you know, doing math and reading maps and, you know, scheduling things. But yeah, it was very much amateur hour, but we had some help, luckily, from a nice gentleman named Howard Monk, from originally from Rochdale, but lived in London at the time. He's the one who booked the Buffalo Bar gig for us. I think he had a night there. Yeah, yeah. We had lots of like hosts really helped us, like our French label guy, this guy named Sean Bouchard, kind of got the ball rolling for us, you know.
And when you signed to that French label, did you have expectations of yourself? Did they have expectations for the National? What was that kind of feeling at the time?
I think it gave us quite a boost of confidence. Maybe I had, you know, I'd traveled once to Europe, like in the 80s, or I went to England in the 80s, you know. I hadn't traveled abroad since then. I think I had like big expectations of, you know, being massive, you know, but that didn't happen, of course. But it was just more fun just to like, you know, see things outside the, you know, just see the world, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, via the motorway and, you know, rest stops. But it was still cool, you know.
And you talk about the Buffalo Bar, which I mentioned before we press record on this, because when you played at the O2, Matt gave a big shout out to the Buffalo Bar. And that made me so excited because, you know, some of my favorite gigs have been at those. I mean, it's cliche to say, isn't it? But, you know, those small pub gigs. You know, you get some real special moments from those nights. I mean, yeah. Maybe it's looking back with rosy eyes as well.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of both. There's a similar venue. There's the Mercury Lounge in New York, where we did a lot of our early shows. As that, but yeah, it speaks. I don't need to say it, but you know, just the intimacy, just how the music sounds is different in a small venue. And it's just, you know, I saw like bands like the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and the Strokes in these smaller venues, and also in larger venues, and there's just no comparison, you know.
Right. And were you going to go, were you seeing the, I mean, you said you did, but were you a big fan of that kind of meet me in the bathroom scene?
I was no part of it. You know, I was just this like bookish, nerdy guy, but I definitely liked the music and thought it was super cool, you know.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah, it was really cool.
And did seeing that scene sort of like so come alive? Because obviously I was pretty young at the time, but you know, the NME was, you know, thriving, writing about that kind of stuff. And that idea of it seemed so magical, you know, it was something that you could kind of do yourself. You know, it was punk rock enough for that, but it was also this kind of very liberating, grandiose thing all at the same time. Did that inspire the way that you wanted to play music and the way that you wanted to be in a band?
For sure, 100%. I mean, if you include, do you know the Walkmen?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, if you include the Walkmen, which I would, in that, I mean, I guess the initial band, Jonathan Fire Eater, is sort of seen as the sort of, you know, patient zero. Or
I haven't heard that.
It's this awesome band. It's the guys, I think three members of the Walkmen were in that band. Seminal, I guess it'd be called. Seminal late 90s, early 2000s New York City band. But I would include the Walkmen in that group with the Strokes, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Interpol, you know, and on and on. And definitely, like, that was, seeing them play was like, oh, you know, you need to play with energy and conviction and be awesome. Otherwise, what's the point, you know? So I very, very much kind of copied their drummers, kind of like, where he's, you know, he's on the shorter side and I'm gigantic, but he has this unique style of play. And I thought, oh, he just hits things really straightforwardly, but it sounds great, you know.
I thought that when I first saw the National, I just didn't think it would be so, so energetic. So is that something that you thought about from very early on then?
I would say about probably 2004 was when things shifted. We had, you know, couple records we self-released, and we were like, we had this EP, and then we realized like, oh, like we just need to like hit things hard and like, you know, go for it. That was like the thing back then. I mean, I don't know if it was related to like the post 9/11 debauchery that was going on, or just the you know, the general zeitgeist, I guess.
Yeah
but yeah, like I say, in the small rooms, like there's something very like effective about just like a clear, identifiable, articulated like drum beat, you know.
I find it's fascinating. Someone a friend said years ago, an older friend said, you know, all his life he's loved the way that you can stand at the back of a gig or a small gig with maybe 40-50 people, see five people get into it, and then watch that spread across the room.
Totally.
And I always think that's a kind of really like magical thing that you see a band react to as well. You know, the dynamic when you're studying someone who's playing and you see them.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, the guys up front on the stage definitely have more of a perspective on, like, you know, the faces in the crowd, as it were. Right. Yeah, for sure.
So 2004, 2005, I wanted to ask about Alligator because, you know, from a fan's point of view, from the Beggars Banquet thing, was it initially released on Beggars?
It was.
So that that must have felt like a pretty sweet jump.
Oh, yeah. It was the greatest thing that ever happened to us. It changed the entire trajectory of the band's career. It was specifically an individual named Roger Trust, who was, I guess, A&R? I don't know. Some sort of, he'd been there forever, you know, and he's the one who signed us to the label. And with that, you know, imprimatur and tour support, that was what launched the band. It enabled us to actually go into the wider world with some, you know, degree of notoriety. You know, it's like, oh, they're on Beggars, you know, they must be legit or something, you know.
Totally. I mean, it's interesting how we all kind of, you know, internally legitimize new records that we hear about. If we read that it's on Beggars Banquet, you know, especially.
Yeah, or 4AD or Matador or on and on, you know.
Exactly. And do you feel like you were prepared for all that at the time? Do you feel like you had it in you to kind of navigate everything that was going on then?
No. It was, you know, it was daunting. I still struggle with, you know, just the anxiety of performing and showing up. But I think we really just showed up and were able to kind of power through. That just kind of got us. It was just through like sheer force of will. And I think that we'd already kind of been doing it kind of like for a few years and just getting a small taste of how, like, oh, but being in a real band, you know what I mean? Like, we were always on the outside looking in on, you know, we saw the Strokes, the it's Interpol, the Walkman, on and on. Go, like, put these awesome records out. We're just kind of like, oh, what are we doing? You know? But so yeah, Alligator was definitely our sort of, our what would you call it, our addition, our attempt to add to that, you know, 2000 to 2005 New York City music thing.
And was there a conflict with the sort of quote unquote real life jobs that were happening around that time?
Happily, there hadn't been. My employers at the press, the Soho Press, it's called, still active company, they enabled me to take time off, unpaid, of course, to tour, you know, like for weeks at a time, which was great. But then, yeah, when Alligator came out, the tours got longer, and my boss, well, the publisher sat me down and she said, you know, you should do this. She encouraged me, you know, that's what she, you know, she herself was an artist and writer and said, do this, you know, but if, you know, if it doesn't work out, you got to get back into publishing. You can only stay out of the business for like a year or two. Otherwise things have moved on, you know, because there's always, you know, new things happening. So
I love hearing about those conversations that you'd have with, you think it might be the manager or the label who have given you these inspiring talks but having someone like a PR, for example, because it's not strictly their job, right?
Right.
It comes from a nice place. That comes from your heart, you know, from what she was saying, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, she was very much a maternal kind of figure, how she ran the business and how she treated people. You know, it's great.
Have you kind of emulated the people that you've met that you like the most, I suppose?
Oh, certainly. I'm a mimic. I like the two people at the Soho Press who unfortunately are now passed away, Laura Ruska and Yuri Yurevitz, are their names. They, I definitely use phrases, like turns of phrase, and they left a deep and lasting impression on me. I just kind of copy things they say, and you know, Yuri, you know, and he's like, in business, you know, antagonism gets you nowhere. You know, he was like a nice guy. You know, I mean, he drove a hard bargain, but you know, he never really, like, it was just really funny. You know, he showed up. I think I was still an intern at this point. It was like a Friday, and like he came in, threw a pair of pajamas at me with a toothbrush. He's like, "We're going to DC on the train." I'm like, "All right, cool." to meet this author, this guy who worked in the State Department, and I was like, you know, at this point I was probably 22 or 23, and I had to tell this grown man who'd served in like foreign wars and stuff, like, like which short stories weren't going to make the collection.
That's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, it was kind of cool. Just like, here you go, kid. So he was with me the whole time. It was, you know, we went together. You know, so
that's still so exciting. I think a lot of early 20s people, you know, kind of expect a job where they're just kind of told what to do and it's probably going to be somewhat boring.
Right.
At least I thought that at that age.
Right. Well, go work for small independent literary presses.
Well, similarly to,
well, right,
to records. I mean, the economics of those two businesses is somewhat kind of fucked up right now, isn't it?
In different ways for sure. I mean, publishing, you know, the publisher assumes all the risk, and often, as you know, was it 50% return rates that they used to be? Maybe it's higher now. But I mean, ebooks have changed the game, obviously. You know.
Yeah.
But like print on demand and audiobooks and podcasts.
Right.
But in music, I mean, it's the history is, it's just littered with, you know, good people dying like dogs at the hands of exploitative, you know, people, you know.
And you must have seen from that, you know, economic side of releasing records, and have you been playing live has that been kind of one of the biggest kind of profitable returns that you've done, or is it, how does that split with records for the National?
I don't have like the figures, but certainly like what you've read in the news about how bands survive. Yeah, it's touring income and merch are very essential. And I think that's why the majors are now trying to get young bands to sign this, the 360 deal where the label takes a piece of everything, you know? Luckily we have had good advice and like managers and tour managers along the way to like, you know, figure out profitability. You know, I get paid to hit things. I can't, you know, I don't have a good head for finances or anything at all.
And I feel awkward asking that question, but I also just find it, you know, fascinating, especially to the, I mean, the National is a, you know, it must be amazing to be in a band where your demographic is basically anyone of any age.
Right.
So I feel like
humans.
Yeah, that's right. And that's so awesome. Uh-huh. That's so cool. Going to a National gig and seeing, you know, families, but also people wanting to have a party time as well. And it makes me think that I've, you know, certainly an impetus of doing this podcast was thinking about that economical side of it. Think about the reality side of it, and I think a lot of people maybe think about that when they go see a band. You know, how is this organization running like a business?
Oh yeah, it completely like any business. There's, you know, profit and loss statements and all that, you know, corporate structure and everything, because, you know, we live in a society of laws still, I guess.
And of course, that's the antidote to making a record.
Yeah, I mean, there's an art and a science to it, I guess, right? Yeah.
Is that something that you and the rest of the members have talked about a lot? Is it something that you try and embrace, try and hit head on?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, because from day one, we were funding it, or really Aaron and Matt were funding the whole operation. So the first order of business was to reimburse them, you know? It's very good to have an open dialogue about, you know, financial things in any relationship, you know,
totally,
so it doesn't fester or become an impasse or some blockade, you know,
for real. And but that gets hard if you love the thing, right? I mean, so many bands are going on tour and not making money from them, but you kind of have to do it.
Yeah, I mean, building the, again, it's stupid, it's building the band, the brand, whatever you want to call it. I mean, yeah, it's a struggle. I mean, there's just so much stuff. Even now, there's more than ever material and releases, and, you know, it's amazing how much stuff, like content, there is, you know.
Right. And you've got Daniel Ek at Spotify saying, well, bands can't release one record every 2 years anymore, you know, which a lot of people were offended by.
Right? Uh-huh. Well, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, I wonder about their business model as well, you know. I don't know that they're necessarily profitable. I mean, there's some metric they judge these companies by, like what it costs the company to retain a subscriber. You know what I mean? And is that exceeding what the subscriptions are bringing in? And in Spotify's case, I think the ratio is astoundingly skewed towards it costs them a lot to keep But they made a lot. I think the podcast thing is what they're doing. They're like signing all these big names. And
totally. Joe Rogan's just migrated, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That was their big, you know,
big thing.
One of the latest things. But I mean, I wish, you know, it's an awesome interface in a way, you know.
Well, that's the struggle, isn't it? Because I use Spotify and I love it because I'm finding out about all these new records. You know, I might be on a train going somewhere or at the gym and I'm like, oh, there's that one. I don't know, My Bloody Valentine record I've just never heard in my life. Today I'm going to listen to it. You can't do that without, you know, with any other. Well, there's a few others, but do you know what I mean? Spotify is the one.
Yeah, no, it's really killer. Because I remember back in the day, it was like you'd go to the record store and like, I know this band. Like, there's no listening station. I'll just buy it on a whim, and now you can just like listen to everything.
And the irony of buying a record back then is like, if you bought it, you kind of listen to it until you like it because you spent the money on it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I suppose, is it sort of an accident? Because, I mean, with, you know, looking at the Royal Green interviews that you've done, of course people are going to ask about The National and Matt's record, and that's actually, that kind of works in The National's favor, doesn't it?
And yeah, in terms of like publicity reach, like, yeah, they're still keeps us mildly relevant, I guess. Yeah, I don't know, I think it's a symptom. I mean, I think it's just a result of just the way things go with us.
Totally.
We all just decide to put out solo projects at the same time.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Does it feel like making, well, you know, putting this record together, has that been like a nice, you know, something different for you?
Oh, completely. So it's so low key because, you know, the audio, you know, was done. Well, not done. It's my work finished probably 5 years ago. And then Nate Martinez, he finished recently, and then we got Josh Kaufman at the very end to play bass. So it was just kind of like this, like everything kind of fell together. Then my brother did all the artwork, and it was just kind of like, you know, no pressure whatsoever. It's like a vanity project in a way. You know, I'm just like doing it myself because it's something I like.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if it's not too blunt of a question, is it something that, you know, you guys enjoy and you can laugh about and fuck around with to an extent and be like, what about this?
Oh,
that
yeah.
Sounds cool.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's serious. I mean, as we're trying to be just, but it's like, I got to like, you know, create my own kind of like art for the sleeve or the inner sleeve. And then a friend of mine's a really good painter, and she did like a painting of a photograph of Nate and myself.
Yeah.
The cover. It's just like kind of
great
like
cover.
A
cover. It's funny.
Yeah. It's just sort of like a, again, like a vanity project that I want to be this like low key representation of a, you know, of a, nowadays they would say mood, but I would say just of sort of like a time capsule of that time, you know, that kind of summery time when you're in the 20s and just, you know, worried about things, but just like having fun with it, you know?
Right. And
sorry.
No, I'm with you. I've got that bad habit of saying right, but no, it must be a really nice way to look back and look forward, if that's not too profound. And you know, the collaboration, you know, of sending a drum beat off for the Folklore and not knowing exactly what it was, that must have been quite fun.
It was hilarious. I was my wife knew immediately, and I was like, nah, it's not Taylor Swift. And then, of course, once that came out, the NDAs, they could tell us, like, oh, it's Taylor Swift. I'm like, duh.
That's funny. And
that was great.
Aaron's role as a producer, there's this whole this wonderful idea of the National family. I mean, the fact that, like, Aaron's producing these big records, you know, you're doing your solo project and Matt's doing his, and there's all these kind of wonderful spinning plates.
Yeah, it's a good, very healthy thing not to have just one thing to focus on, you know, which is how I tend to work. My mother warned me as a child, like, don't focus on, but don't have more than one flower in your garden or something. That's how she put it. But like, yeah, no, definitely. I mean, obviously it boosts the public image of the band in a way. But Aaron's been, he's a prolific worker. He just constantly works, but he's produced a lot of records. Over the years. I mean, he did Frightened Rabbit stuff.
Oh, wow.
This American artist named Adia Victoria. He did some stuff with the Mumfords and Sons.
Right.
And there's like lots of other stuff. He just has a real like interest and talent for that. So, but he also likes to write his own stuff and work, you know, on that. But yeah, he just works a lot more than me. I'm lazy, you know.
I'm sure not. I was looking at your Discogs. I mentioned it earlier. You're prolific.
Well, I guess in that sense, I maybe just beat myself up. You know, just kind of like I haven't really properly played drums in a long time. Like I do really? The practice pad and I mess with drum machines and record little beats like this thing for Folklore, but I haven't properly sat down and like. But I think it's a good thing. Just physically, I'm pretty creaky. So,
have you got a setup at home? I mean, you just mentioned the pads, but do you have an acoustic drum room?
I do, but the drums are stacked up. If we were on video, I could show you. It's a nice. It's like a soundproofed basement box.
Oh, cool.
But it's quite nice. It gets really good. Since it's small, the low end is pretty satisfying. But yeah, just record. I record like drum machines through amps, and I have Pro Tools that I got to relearn it, you know. But anyway,
what have you found to keep you inspired and keep you getting a good feeling, keeping you stimulated over the years? Because you talk about your mum saying, you know, don't have just one flower in your garden. I mean that's got to be really difficult when the National was touring so much, you know, and you have this great success. That is a big job in itself, and I imagine it's hard to kind of get away from that just for a second. What else can you find that stimulates you?
Oh yeah, well I mean, I'm blessed with three children, so that's kind of hands full with that, you know. So that's nothing but stimulating, like 24/7. I mean, the younger years are the really like intense ones. Now they're above. They're all in grade school or primary school, whatever, at this point. So it's a lot mellower in terms of like the, you know, don't want them to die on your watch kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, because like even their babies, like they got to put them on their back in the cribs. You have a monitor, and it's a 24-hour endeavor. You know.
When the first one came, presumably the National were quite busy. Was there a period of time back then that you and, you know, because the other members have kids as well, some of them, don't they?
Yeah, everybody does, yeah.
Did the first ones all come around the same time?
Not in the same year, but in succession. Our first kid was like middle of 2011. And actually the due date was like the day after we were playing a festival in Spain.
Wow. Did you make it back in time?
So luckily I was... Made it back in time. Yeah, he was like 11 days late or seven. I can't remember. It wasn't 11. I think it was seven. I think they had a plan in place because I think the baby doesn't just pop out. Like there's labor starts. It can be 3 days. You know, it can be 24 hours. It can be 7 hours. But I think the thinking was we'd have enough time to get me to an airport and fly me back. We had like a plan.
That adds a very wholesome vibe.
Right.
Well, amazing. I mean, thank you so much, Brian. I mean, what's coming up, you know, over the next, you know, music wise, writing wise for you?
Oh gosh. Well, I should have mentioned this band I'm in with my brother, Ben Lands, who plays in the Nationals live, who has been with us for like, you know, 13 years. So Ben Lands, my brother, and a guy named Aaron Arntz have a project called Lansendorf.
I've been trying to figure out how to say that.
Yeah, we kind of, I don't know, we took the vowels out because that was the trend at the time, and it just looked, and there was a town, there's a town called Lansendorf in Austria, so we wanted to like differentiate it.
Yeah,
yeah. So we just put out an EP, we have an LP coming out in January. Nate Martinez, my collaborator on Royal Green, and I have this instrumental sort of brainwave type of recording going on.
Cool. How do you mean brainwave?
Well, I don't know if that's the right... He studies things like binaural beats and these like certain frequencies played, like two different frequencies played at the same time create the illusion of a third or something, and then that in certain frequencies will influence brainwave patterns.
Cool.
I don't know. It sounds like Scientology, but it's not. It's like it's actually based in science.
Nice.
Yeah. Anyway, so he and then I just gotta provide, like, he just chops up electric drum beats that I send him and uses these synths and waveforms and I don't know.
And your sort of newly acquired talent of Pro Tools, is that coming, you know, front and center for that?
Oh yeah, that's the project this winter, is to learn Pro Tools, expand my guitar knowledge, and get a live set together to do some Royal Green shows here in Cincinnati, like in the spring.
Cool.
Like outdoor distanced things, I guess.
To what extent is your guitar playing currently?
It was decent 20 years ago. It's nowhere near that. I just can play like the basic chords, you know.
Do you feel like writing material, playing chords, does that come naturally to you?
I think little melodic fragments come naturally, but I haven't really applied myself to write a complete song other than like the first song on the Royal Green record. That's the only song I wrote on that. I like hearing pitches and just sort of like kind of building like harmonies, you know.
Yeah, cool.
Oftentimes with the drum machines, you know, just getting a pitch on a tom and, you know.
Right.
Doing that. But again, I don't know what I'm doing in terms of, I couldn't tell you if it's an A or a B or anything. I just hear sound.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if that works in the best ways it can do sometimes. You're not doing something because it's, you know, a written thing.
Yeah. I think if I'm able to actually, I think it's all about putting the time in, you know, really just like time. That's what it takes to actually play these instruments.
Yeah.
You just got to put the time in.
When you're playing the drums now, do you look back at the time when you started the National and you think, you know, how much of your style has changed in that regard?
Oh, a great deal. I mean, I've seen old videos. It's totally different, you know, from the beginning. So, I mean, I've probably played, I didn't start playing drums until I was like, I think 14 maybe. But, you know, I've probably hit the drums literally billions of times, you know.
That must be funny for your family as well.
Yeah. My dad's funny. He's like, people like kind of like ask him, like, you must have been musical. And he's like, nah, nothing to do with it. But of course, he had everything to do with it because he was so supportive and like, got me the drum set. You know, he's a totally different guy. You know, he was like an Eagle Scout, you know, went to the army to pay for college, flew helicopters in Vietnam, you know. But super sweet. He's not like a militant person at all. He's just like a, you know, solid dude from the Midwest, you know.
And is that a common thing with your parents in the National? Was everyone quite supportive during those early years?
Oh yeah, everyone. Yeah, well, the twins' mother, Sally, for our high school band, she would allow us to drive their car. So the band was based in New Orleans, so we'd drive from Cincy to New Orleans in her car. She'd like pack bunch of sandwiches and Cokes and a cooler for us, you know.
Amazing.
It was really sweet.
How far is that drive?
It's really long. I mean, I don't know the mileage, but it's probably like 16, 18 hours.
Wow. That's some good family support there.
Yeah, it's a haul.
Brilliant. Well, Brian, it's been so nice to hear about you and ask about, you know, some things that, you know, fascinate me about the National, you know, the inner workings of a band. So I hope I haven't asked too many kind of boring questions that...
Oh, no, I love this stuff. Thank you for the incisive questions.
No, brilliant. Okay, well, have a lovely rest of your day.
You too, man. Thank you, Giles. Good talking to you, man. Have a great week.
You too, Brian.
Cheers.
See you later.
Bye-bye. I've been working all day.
This is a Mighty Moon Media podcast.